At Breaking the Glass Slipper, we believe it is important to have conversations about women and issues of intersectional feminism within science fiction, fantasy, and horror. To continue to do so, we need your help. Please consider supporting us on Patreon. Join the conversation by following us on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram.
Hello, and welcome to Breaking the Glass Slipper. I'm Charlotte Bond.
I'm Megan Lee.
And I'm Lucy Hounsom.
The literature of our past is littered with casual gender biases. You describe someone as a witch, and the natural assumption is that they are female. But according to the great Diane Purkis, while mostly women were accused in the English witch trials, in some of the Scandinavian countries, men were in the slight majority. In fact, around 6,000 men were put to death as suspected witches. That gender bias is at play when it comes to secret societies too. Until recently, the words cult and secret magic society conjured up images of groups of men in hooded robes, chanting, lighting incense, and committing unspeakable faceless acts of magic. Unless, of course, you were reading a book about girls at a boarding school, or perhaps an Enid Blyton book, where they do admittedly have a different connotation. But modern authors are all about overturning tired tropes and challenging assumptions, and none more so than today's guest, S.T. Gibson. Her new book, Evocation, is the first in a series that sees witches and male-dominated secret societies coming into conflict and working together to overcome great evil. Saint, thank you for joining us. Please tell us a little bit about your work.
Hello. Thank you so much for having me. My name is Saint. I write under S.T. Gibson, and I primarily write gothic romance and fantasy romance. Evocation is my newest work. It kicks off the Summoner Circle series, which is a urban fantasy romance series that follows the lives and loves of a group of magicians living in Boston.
I'm in the middle of reading it, and I have to say it's really good fun. It's kind of familiar and cozy and yet challenging at the same time. I really like the balance you struck there.
Oh, I love that. Thank you.
So obviously, just a little bit of background. We've got Moira, who's a witch, and she's married to Reese, who is, along with David, part of a secret society. And they're both guys. And one of the things that I thought was really interesting is the way that you had lineage as a sort of differentiator of power. So, for example, witches have ancestral practices rooted in home and community, while sorcery is related to monks and mystery cults, and in particular David, his lineage and his source of his power is a huge part of the book. So what made you decide that's where my boundary is going to lie?
Yeah, that's a great question. I feel like oftentimes, especially when we're discussing religious traditions and magical traditions and occultism, these differentiators and these boundaries, especially in the modern era, are already kind of nebulous. Like if you speak to any occultist or any witch or magical practitioner, folk magician, see, I'm already saying there's so many categories, and you ask them how they feel about certain labels or language to use for themselves, you're going to get a really diverse set of answers. But these are kind of two approaches to magic that kind of live in the home of Reese and Moira and in their own lives that I wanted to highlight and explore. Moira identifies as a witch, and at least where we see her in book one, her tradition is very focused on what she's learned from her family system, the way that she serves and is integrated into the magical community, and the services she provides as a tarot reader and an astrologer, whereas Reese has a much more academic bent towards what he is doing as a sorcerer. But something that is also really fun to explore that I hope I get to explore a little bit more in later books is that those binaries and those divisions are not as opposite as they may seem. But when we first meet these characters and we start on their journey with them, there is this tension between kind of intra-society magic and extra society magic as well.
Did you kind of have a leaning towards which one you preferred? I mean, I think about obviously some of the bigger fantasy novels, and you often have, you know, old magic and new magic, or the magic of the sorcerer versus the magic of the hedge witch. And, you know, it's very clear that one is right and one is wrong and all this kind of thing. One is too powerful or one is whatever. But I didn't get that in your book. I get that you felt both sources of magic were equally valid. Were you aiming for that? And did you sort of have a leaning towards, well, if I had to be in one of the cults, I'd be with Moira or I'd be with Reese and David?
Thank you so much for saying that. That was actually something that was really premier in my mind and really important to me as I was constructing the series, and more specifically Evocation, is I wanted to showcase the diversity of living, breathing, religious and magical traditions, at least the ones that I had been fortunate enough to learn about or practice or know folks who practiced, and kind of present them all as being in conversation with each other and highlighting certain strengths and weaknesses of different approaches to the supernatural without, you know, passing judgment on one as being more powerful or more morally good or more modern or anything like that. And something that's been so wonderful about writing this series is it really is kind of a built-in excuse for me to do eternal continuing education into occultism and into religion, which is something I'm really passionate about and something that I really love learning about. I've always been interested in spirituality since I was very, very young. I've gone through a number of kind of religious and spiritual expressions. I went to grad school to train to be an Episcopalian priest while I was also researching occultism and writing Evocation. So I do have a very mixed, blended background, and I love to learn. And I love the way the study of religion and the study of magic continually expands my worldview and continually breaks down perceived binaries and kind of highlights my own biases as well. So it's been a really, really gratifying writing process. I go in and out. I will say I have been a tarot reader professionally before. I've been a tarot reader for about 10 years now, professionally for about 5 years of that. Tarot was incredibly near and dear to my heart. And I probably know more about astrology than your average person, but only enough to be interesting at a party. I wouldn't call myself an astrologer. But, you know, ancestor veneration is also a big part of my spiritual practice. Certain elements of liturgical Christianity are a big part of my spiritual practice. And I do have a light background in ceremonial magic as well. I would not call myself a ceremonial magician. But again, I've probably done more reading and more experimentation in that arena than your average person. And it is something I'm interested in learning more about. So yeah, that's kind of a non-answer, but I truly do have a bottomless appetite to learn about this stuff and to showcase it in a way that is thoughtful, but also celebratory and respectful.
Do you know, when I was reading about Moira doing her astrology charts and things and the detail it went into, and I'm like, either this person knows their stuff or they've done masses of research and they've just gone into a hole for like a year, because it was so detailed. I couldn't believe, you know, how much detail and how much accuracy, and just it really drew me in. I felt like, you know, these people, it was definitely part of their lives and that this was the reason that they lived and breathed and what they did. And that clearly comes from how much you've been exposed to it yourself and how much you've woven into the book. It was fantastic.
Thank you.
Can you talk us through a little bit about your secret society? Because like both the magic and the structure of the society rely on hereditary power and position. And when we see stories of secret societies, they often feature recruits who are either, you know, legacy members or those who, you know, face this rigorous hazing to join. So could you talk a bit about like the hereditary aspect, what you wanted to achieve? Secret societies are they're sort of an evergreen trope, I guess, or like they're a popular subject. Yeah, we just want to hear some of your thoughts about like how you went about creating yours.
Absolutely. So I think there's a maybe two or three different kind of axes of tension in the society that I found really exciting to explore. The first being this axis of like class or financial access, right? The second being what you mentioned about hereditary versus kind of self-taught or newer inductees. Hereditary referring to the fact that some of these men, like David, for example, have had family members in society that have been brought up in this culture, whereas other folks like Reese are kind of flying solo and have been, you know, self-teaching and learning as they go. And then there's also an axis of experience versus youth. There's this tension in the society between who Reese generally refers to as like the older set, who are the brothers who have been in the society for 20, 30, 40 years and are maybe a little bit more set in their ways, but do have access to the wisdom and the benefit of experience and the power that comes with that, as opposed to the younger men who are a little bit more hungry, a little bit more experimental, and a little bit more, willing to participate in modern culture, but who don't have access to the wealth of wisdom that experience gives you. So that was just a really fun space to play in. And, you know, I think having characters that occupy different areas of that, especially when those areas and those axes overlap, that was really cool and fun. So again, you have David, who is not only extraordinarily wealthy, but has this hereditary power that he can access, both in terms of my father was a society member and threw a lot of money around and you know my name, as well as I was born with some very strong psychic gifts. Then you have Reese, who's just as an adept sorcerer, very, very powerful, very, very smart, but does not have access to that financial power or that family name, which is kind of a source of tension in their rivalry for the high priesthood and for and in their relationship as friends and then eventually their romantic relationship. So I think using the characters to explore that and front loading those themes integrated into the characters was the way that, at least for me, was the most interesting and the most accessible to explore that. And then you have other folks like Antony, a character who I love, who does have the benefit of youth and energy and kind of that bottomless curiosity. He's very affable. He's very well liked and he has access to financial resources. However, he has dealt with some systemic barriers through being a transgender man and also just being as young as he is. He's one of the youngest members. And that did cause some friction at the beginning when he was first inducted before everything was kind of smoothed out and some of the more bigoted members got the boot. So it is a really fun thing to explore. And I think it is something that is present in a lot of religious and magical communities, especially the more insular you get. I have spent a lot of my time in and out of different different religious and magical communities. And those tensions are very, very real. Even when you're gathering together in the pursuit of transcendence or unification with the divine or power or whatever it may be, you still have that baggage of things like class, gender, money, status, all that kind of stuff. And it was important for me to portray that.
So basically, conflict.
Oh, we love it. We love conflict.
Well, you know, that's what story needs. So we get it, totally. but you also have like quite a friendly secret society. I mean, as Charlotte mentioned, mm-hmm. You know, when kind of at least for me or for many of us, when we think about a secret society, you know, it's quite dark and terrifying and like you don't really... I guess, you know, like the brotherhood, the sisterhood stuff, you know, the kind of the friendliness and the, you know, buoying each other up and that sort of thing. Like that isn't something you really think about generally when you see these secret societies. It's all very cruel and harsh and everyone's out to get everybody else and so on and so forth. And I just wondered, you know, because you are writing in the context of today where we have conspiracy theories just everywhere. And we have this idea that some people think that there are these secret societies controlling the politics and the world and anything.
And cough, cough, Assassin's Creed.
You know, and I just sort of wondered, like, if maybe if you wanted to approach this secret society, like, in a friendly way, like, how this is kind of, you know, like, I don't know, I guess a way against that negative perception, or was there a completely different reason for you wanting to create a more friendly kind of secret society?
I think there's a couple elements at play here. I think the first is the fact that at the end of the day, I know myself and I'm an incredibly character-driven romance writer. I like to think I write serviceable fantasy and horror and all those other elements, but I am really drawn into those relationships. And so I think having an element of conviviality, an element of the gossiping and the brotherhood and the friendship and the betrayal and the reunification, like, that was so important to me to explore. And I also think, as someone who in my life has spent a lot of time looking behind the curtain of religion and of spirituality. I think I do have a little bit of a different perspective on it than maybe some other folks. You know, for example, when I was in grad school, all of my friends were priests and chaplains. And, you know, I was friends with bishops and deacons. And, you know, I have really been on the end of how human that is, how messy, you know, your religious leaders are still people who, like, more often than not are like dealing with their own like mental health and ambitions and hopes and dreams and frustrations and their own vices and virtues. And at the end of the day, we are all just people, even if we are people who have been elevated to a status of extreme influence and power. And I think if you lose sight of the fact that we are all just people in relationship with other people, that is when it becomes much more easy for abuses of power and things like that to happen, which wasn't necessarily something I was trying to say with the book, but it is something that's always in my mind. And, you know, I've also spent a good amount of time in like in and out of Wiccan groups, occult study groups, tarot meetups. It is so fun, and it is this sense of transcendence and this sense of community and the pursuit of something greater, but it also is a hotbed for drama. Everyone's dating everyone, everyone's divorced from everyone, or I was a mentee under this person, and then we had a falling out, and now they're teaching my rival. Like, that's very, very common. So I just spent so much time in these spaces where I was like, this is juicy story. And it's something that I really love to talk about. So it was natural that I would set it there. And then moving on to the great element of your question about conspiracy, I think so often, and this is true historically, and it's certainly true in the present day, the occult can be a hotbed for conspiracy theories and for the kind of philosophies and pseudosciences that can lead to, you know, anything from social strife to something as extreme as fascism. And it has been used historically in that way. You know, you have figures like, I'm just throwing out a name here, but like Helena Blavatsky, who, you know, is a very prominent, you know, and in many ways respected occult figure, but her legacy will always be tainted and shrouded by the fact that a lot of her teachings were used to supplement more fascist ideals and policies. And, you know, she has her own history of racism and antisemitism as well. And I also will point out while we're on this topic, a lot of times when we kind of get into this idea of the unseen occult cabal controlling society and politics, you're typically veering pretty close, if not totally, in the category of anti-Semitic or xenophobic ideas. So it is a fine line to walk, and that's something I was really careful and mindful of, and that's why I chose not to play so much into the conspiratorial aspect. Yes, the society in Boston does have some measure of power. Reese would love it if they had more. And there is a sense of magical and social influence, but it's on more of a human level. It's on more of that communities coming together, that political level, that financial level that is really tied to the mundane as well as being tied to the supernatural. So kind of a long meandering answer, but basically I love love. I love drama. I love friendship. I cannot resist making all my little characters sit in rooms in cool clothes and talk about their feelings. But I also wanted to show a side of occultism and of religion and philosophy that to me feels very lived in, very earthy, very embodied, very carnal, and very much like home, as opposed to maybe a more heady, shadowy, conspiratorial view of the occult.
That leads us nicely on to another question that I wanted to ask, which is, when we think of secret societies and occultism and things like that, we tend to come at it from things that we've read rather than things that we've experienced. And for what you've been saying today, it's very clear that obviously there's a lot of your own experience in there. So I wanted to ask, are there any tropes about secret societies out there in books and novels or in the media or whatever that you wanted to either embrace or overturn? Because you mentioned there are lots of juicy stories within your societies and things. So is there stuff out there that you go, yeah, that totally happens, or stuff that you go, that never happens?
Yeah, I just feel like maybe I touched on it in earlier questions, but something I can talk about that I'm happy to talk about is how I did choose to portray the magic. There was definitely like a line to walk. And I don't know if I walked it. We're going to find out. We're still learning. But there was a line to walk between sharing enough about these magical traditions that I had learned, at least, that the audience would be able to envision them and have a sense of their distinction without overstepping and kind of centering myself as an educator about traditions I'm not myself a part of, and also not boring the audience, you know? Like, I think that the details of a goetic summoning are really interesting, but the audience probably only needs like a high level breakdown. And also I think there's a level of kind of spiritual responsibility as well, where I wanted to draw the reader into this world, whether they're coming at it from totally a place of, I just want a fun fantasy story, I just want a romance, I'm down for the ride, let's look at some magic, it's going to be super fun, or someone who had a little bit more of an interest or a background in religion or magic and was reading this book and was like, ooh, chaos magic, that's kind of cool. Maybe I should like read up on that. I'm not really sure what that's about. Or, you know, I would like to get more into tarot. So I wanted there to be a little bit of something for everyone.
And I certainly found that. I certainly found when I was reading it that it touched on so many different things, and there was a lot of little bits, and I kind of got drawn in just enough. And like you say, it's a fine balance between trying to write enough that you can give an idea of it and not so much that everybody's overwhelmed. I think you hit the perfect balance, and I imagine it was quite difficult. And you know, and you're so enthusiastic about it from your own life as well to narrow it down for someone else.
Yeah, a lot of the early, like I'm talking early feedback I got on this book a couple years ago from betas and from my agent was like, hey, girly pop, we love you and we love that you love this so much, but we really do not need 3 full pages of David and Moira discussing the intricacies of a star chart and how the natal transit of the moon, or how the, you know, the current lunar transit is affecting the natal chart. And I was like, okay. Well, I did try to pare it back a little bit while still leaving those fun, juicy, sexy details.
So there's a different draft out there somewhere that is full of technical details for people who want to know then.
Oh, yes. It's mostly a lot of David and Moira talking about the finer points of mediumship and astrology to a level of detail that A, nobody needs to know. And B, I was just like, I did the research, I'm putting it in, I guess. I'm a bit of an overwriter. And then also a lot of like Reese POV of him like intricately reverse engineering these rituals. And then I realized I was kind of overwriting them and over justifying them. And, you know, I didn't have to build a watertight ritual just to put it in a book. And so there is room for artistic license. And even though all of these traditions that are featured in the book are based in or representative of real world traditions, there's totally artistic license here. Like, especially around David's demon deal, that gets pretty far into the territory of like fantasy storytelling, although it is rooted in real folklore and real, real stories.
Okay. I want to shift gears a little bit and talk about some romance.
Yes.
So you have a lovely little trio of main characters, 2 men and a woman, 2 sorcerers and a witch, married couple and a pair of exes. Now, with love triangles, what we tend to see in fiction, you know, it's often 2 men and a woman, like you have here. But it's usually like the woman has to choose between one of the men. And you did not go there, which is very fun. So I just wanted to know, like, what did you hope to say by flipping this trope? And also, like, obviously, for me, I have a lot of friends who are actually poly. And so this is, you know, it's really nice to see them represented. And I love that. But, you know, why did you want to include something like a polyamorous relationship, and specifically like that transition from a monogamous marriage to becoming a polycule? It's just all fascinating. And I just loved this.
So many of my books end up being polyamorous romances, and I cannot resist for me as a reader and as a writer, I cannot resist the depth and the complexity and also the drama and the angst, but also the bottomless potential for love and connection that expanding the relationship universe offers. So even sometimes I'll start out a book, oftentimes I start a book and I have my set group of people, but sometimes I'll start a book and it's just a couple, and then inevitably, you know, somebody else shows up or two other people show up because I really love seeing how that makes the characters interact with each other in like a deeper, more charged way, whether that's charged with eroticism or friendship or a sense of family. Like, it's just endlessly fascinating to me. And I really am one of these people who truly believes that love is a bottomless, limitless, renewable resource that can be truly transformative if we allow it to do the uncomfortable work of transforming us. So that, I think, is why I always come back to that theme generally. And I totally hear you about a lot of times. I will say it is changing. I feel like in the last like 5 years or so and into the future, we're seeing some awesome trad books that have poly romances being picked up, or just really kind of complex, messy relationships with permeable boundaries, which I love reading about. Can't get enough of it. And also, you know, Why Choose has been huge in indie for a while. As usual, indie oftentimes sets the trend and is the tastemaker, and then trad kind of follows and puts its own spin on it to a certain degree. But yeah, so a lot of times you do see the classic trope of, you know, it's a love triangle, and it's a triangle in which the corners don't really touch. And it is typically one woman who has to choose between the affection of two men, typically two men that represent different desires and different sides of her and different possible futures. And I am not a hater of that trope. I think there's a really rich history there, and there's some really cool things you can do with it. And it, like any other trope, can also be done in a way that is very surface level and pretty predictable. So I am not a love triangle hater, but I have seen it done poorly and I've seen it done well. And I tend not to find myself drawn into telling those kinds of stories, because for me, I love to reach a happy ending where there is a sense of the unification of the triangle. Even if, like in this case, Moira and David don't have a sexual necessarily relationship, but they do have a very intimate, arguably a romantic friendship that has this special element of a psychic connection, like the spiritual connection that they have when they touch each other. And that was something that was not in the first couple of drafts. And I was like, something is just like missing here. Like, I know they're more important to each other than is coming across on the page. There's something really special and distinct here. And when I kind of unlocked that and took it a level deeper and gave them that spiritual connection, it was just like fireworks. I love it. This is one of my favorite relationships out of any relationship in the whole series. And there are many, many to choose from, is what exists between Moira and David. So they're bound by that, in addition to being bound by, yes, their general friendship and their general sense of being colleagues, but their deep love of Rhys. And I love writing triads because the person that's in the middle of the V, or the person that is quote unquote making the choice or being desired from multiple people, if that is how you're setting up the romance, it does offer an opportunity for them sometimes to deeply integrate different parts of themselves, to love in different ways, to experience, just have different experiences that kind of help them in their growth. And I'm really excited to kind of take Rhys there and make him really uncomfortable and make him grow in the future. But I love it. I mean, I could talk about this all day, but it's something I'm super passionate about. And I do hope that love translates to the love between the characters in the book.
Yeah, I liked when you were saying, you know, oh, it was just fireworks. And I was like, because I was about to jump in and go, yeah, that's just hot, right?
It is. Yeah, no, it's been really cool. I'm not the kind of writer who, and no shade to these kind of writers, this is really fine, but I'm not the kind of writer who's like, oh, my characters just talk to me and they tell me the story and I write down what they're saying. And for me, it's more helpful for me to kind of keep front and center this sense of like, I'm the writer. It's my decisions. I'm responsible for the decisions that I make. I have agency. So I need to be as intentional with the choices I make with characters as possible. But that said, there is this kind of sense of magic that happens when you have characters who reveal something about themselves in the writing or interact with each other in a way that you were not expecting. And for me, at least in Evocation, there's some other kind of magical moments I've discovered in later books as I've been writing them. But in Evocation, a really big one for that was whatever David and Moira have going on. And I'm really into it and I really like exploring it. And it's very special to me.
You have two of your characters who are sensitive to ghosts and one can sense nothing at all. And we were wondering, like, how did that play out in the power dynamics, you know, between the trio? Like, how does that manifest in their relationship? Is the balance of power something you also wanted to explore?
I spent so much time workshopping that, and I spend a lot of time as I write the rest of the series workshopping that. It is very front and center in my mind, is I do want all the characters in general, but especially that core trio, to be bringing different strengths and weaknesses to the table that when you kind of put them all together, create something new, but also create that friction and that conflict and that tension, because that is like the juicy discomfort where characters do really cool things and where good stories happen and where we grow as people. So it was super important to me that Reese has zero magical aptitude naturally. David has a great line that I love that I think is something along the lines of like, Reese had the magical, the intuitive aptitude of a Roomba. Like, he just, everything that he has learned has been through his power of will, ambition, and study, which is a superpower within itself, but he does not have access to the kind of natural, embodied, I guess what we would call spiritual giftings of someone like Moira and David, who do both have psychic gifts in different ways. And they have different skills as well that, you know, are kind of in tension with each other. You know, one of the lines in the book is David is better with the dead than he is with the living. And Moira is better with the living than she is with the dead. And that is a place where they are trying to help each other grow and expand their skill set without totally, you know, losing it in the process, because it is, it's kind of a mind-bending thing to do. So I hope there is a sense of balance, but I never get tired of balancing and rebalancing those scales and seeing what comes out of it. But yeah, the fact that Reese has gotten as far as he has just on basically book learning and refusing to quit and wanting the world is incredibly essential to his character and the role that he occupies in the society.
I think that's like an important part of these kinds of stories, because as someone who is a bit of a bookworm, who studies and works hard, you know, we on this show, we've talked a lot about Chosen Ones over the years. And, you know, sometimes when you just see over and over again the kinds of characters who just kind of get born into somehow this capability, it gets a little tiring sometimes because you want to see people work for it a little bit.
Never.
No, I'm with Megan. You want to see the work and the book.
We know you are, because you hate the Chosen One.
I mean, if we want to talk about subverting tropes, I think the number one trope for me that I wanted to subvert with Evocation that I had a blast doing is a variation on the Chosen One trope, which you just were outlining, which is in David. Like, David literally, when we meet him, it appears like he has it all. He's incredibly wealthy. He comes from a very powerful family. He has an esteemed day job and he has this psychic gift. Like, he really is kind of this, you know, almost like power fantasy, or, you know, those wonderful romance heroes that are just a little bit larger than life. You know, that is really David. But the thing that he doesn't have is that ability to access deep community and deep love and deep self-esteem, which I know is very like power of lovey, but I love the power of love trope and I probably always will. And so it was really fun to make him like put him into situations where it was like all the money and all the access and all the quote unquote power in the world means nothing if you are isolated, burned out, suffering alone, and you have no friends and connections. And I think that is what he learns the hard way in this. And then once he finally opens up through this painful kind of decalcification of his heart, you realize he really does have a heart of gold. He really loves deep and hard. He just doesn't often allow himself to, and that hasn't been modeled for him. What has been modeled for him is this golden child, hyper masculine, hyper performative view of always being perfect. I don't know if anyone here is into the Enneagram. It's like a little categorization system for personalities. It does have some roots in Christianity. So if that's a turnoff for you, no problem. But it can be valuable sometimes, the same way, you know, knowing your Myers-Briggs, your star sign can be valuable sometimes. And David, for me, is like the model of an Enneagram 3. And the model of that type is someone who ties their worth and their ability to quote unquote deserve love to their success and to their performance. And they're always performing and they're always working through the fear that they are inherently unlovable. So that is David's little crucible that he goes through in order to become a more actualized version of himself and a better person to the people around him.
Did you like actually map those out for different characters, or is just that something that you kind of, when you wrote him, you figured, oh yeah, he maps pretty well to that?
I know bits and pieces for a lot of my characters, not all of them. Like, some characters have tarot cards assigned to them. I know the Myers-Briggs or the Enneagram for some of my characters. And for like the big three, I know like their astro roughly, just because that symbolic language for me is really helpful. But I have that kind of brain, like stories and symbols are kind of naturally what I go to when I'm trying to make meaning of my own life, which is probably why I like religion and magic and philosophy so much, because it's all stories and symbols making meaning. But yeah, for David, at least, I was working with that model. And in full transparency, I am also an Enneagram 3. So David was a really great opportunity for me to work through some things about myself that I'm really proud of and I like a lot, and some things about myself that I really don't like. He's by no means a one-to-one self-insert, but there is a lot of me and a lot of the people I love and a lot of the characters in this book. And I think David and I kind of have that same core success drive and that same core wound, which it was actually very, very cathartic to write through.
Yeah. I mean, writing is therapy. What's not to
Oh, mean? Yes. It is my best therapy.
And, you know, it doesn't cost as much.
Exactly.
Okay, so we've talked quite a bit about David and his charisma and his charm. But one of the things that I remember from the book is that at one point, right at the very beginning, Rhys summons a demon to give him a little extra charisma in an interview. And I just wanted to end and ask a very silly question, which is, if you could summon a demon for something small but significant, what would it be?
Ooh, good, good question. This is something, and this is true for magic, I found this is something that is so easy to fix myself that if I just did the work, I wouldn't need the demon.
It's always the way.
But if there was a little demon out there, or a little familiar spirit, or a daemon, or whatever we want to call them, that could help me never be late to anything again, I would love that. Because even my...
Awesome.
Yeah, even at my age, and even with all of the calendar reminders and the phone alarms, I'm kind of a chronic forgetter, and I'm chronically late to a lot of things, even if only by a few minutes. So if I could just have a little critter on my shoulder that was like, hello, your appointment starts in 12 minutes, that would be awesome.
Now, you see, if you're going to summon a demon for that, I think you need one that packs your bags for you and finds the car keys that you've lost that add an extra 2 minutes to it. And you know, goes around and checks you've turned all the lights off and everything. I think that's what I want my demon to do with that.
That's very useful. That's good.
So, brilliant. Thank you. Well, thank you so much for joining us, Saint. It was fabulous. And we really enjoyed the book. It's a lot of fun, a lot of knowledge. It was really, really great. And I hope our listeners check it out.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me.
Thank you.
Breaking the Glass Slipper is written and produced by Megan Lee, Charlotte Bond, and Lucy Hounsome. Please help us spread the word. Subscribe and leave a review on your preferred podcast platform. We want to hear from you. Let us know what you would like to hear on the next episode of Breaking the Glass Slipper.